The reading this morning is entitled, Nat Turner Finds Out That I Am Considering Not Going Back to School to Finish My Undergraduate Degree. And I've given you the name of, in the order of service, you have the name of the book of poetry that that poem comes out of. And for those of you whose historical minds are failing you this morning, Nat Turner was the leader of a slave rebellion in 1831, a violent rebellion. I am at a table by the wall, hugging a small coffee with both hands. Nat walks into the nutmeg-filled shop, lays a wrinkled hand on my shoulder. I stand, breathless. We exit the diner together. Outside on the sidewalk under the gray sky, I lean into his heavy shadow. I am drunk in the gravity of his bones. He holds my hand as we walk, and instantly I am 11 years old again. I want nothing more than to hear him speak. His lips, a mountain range above his chin. We walk this way. Two matches, one lit. We walk down the street until we arrive at a cemetery. We walk to the center of the gated field. He presses his hand against my cheek. I feel no heartbeat, but his skin is buzzing. The sky rolls into dusk. He slaps me hard, surrounded by tombstones. Says first, some of us ain't even got no rock. My whole face is hot. He presses his hand against my cheek. I smell blood. I begin to cry. I am so sorry. He touches my shoulder. He kisses my forehead. He drags his thumb under each eye and brushes away the water and salt. The humid air leaves sweat above his eyebrows. I continue to cry. From my lip, I can taste that I am leaking blood. Says second, our people know these two things best, water and salt. We cry when we run out of sweat. We sweat when we run out of cry. Nat sweating, me cheek burning, still crying, both of us surrounded by rocks and ghosts. For an hour we stay gathered here, buried in fog. I stop crying. We make eye contact for the first time. Says last, good, you tired of cry. Now go back to school and sweat. My four-year-old talks about death a lot. It may be one of the job hazards from me, or it may just be him. He's curious about everything. He asks his grandparents, all in their mid-70s, about their parents, who have all been dead for years now. He asks, who were they? When did they die? Where did they die? He has also asked them, who is your mom now? Because, of course, he cannot imagine not having a mom. We've tried to explain that your mom is your mom even after she dies, but that doesn't make sense to him. He's with me, and that's how the world is. And this spring, the two of us have gotten to be out in the world together a lot. We took a walk out in the woods a few weeks ago, out at Wagon Hill in Durham, in early spring, when that first brush of green was on the trees. And if you walk out toward the water there, you come across one of those old graveyards that are sprinkled across New England. My child calls gravestones dying stones. He thinks that when you are ready to die, you go and sit on one of these and die. Kind of like an elevator to the next world. We have explained a few times that that's not really how gravestones work, but it hasn't changed how he thinks about them. And at this point in his life, it doesn't matter. It's all kind of magical for him still. So as we approached these stones in the woods, he was a little wary. This was the first time, I think, that it had looked like you could just walk up to them. And he wanted to know what would happen if he sat on one of the stones. I reassured him that he would not die if he sat on one, that they didn't work for just anyone. He seemed reassured, and so we went in and walked among these old stones. It's the kind of stones where the names and dates are half blurred because they're so old. And one of them, from 17-something, had a small American flag stuck in the ground next to it, along with one of those little metal markers to say this person served in the armed forces for this country. Well, my child, of course, plucked the flag out of the ground before I could react and started to wave it around. And then he started back to the path that we had been walking on, still waving his flag, clearly ready to lead the march. So I had to explain that the flag really needed to stay here. Why? No one's using it. Clearly, he is encountering this from the perspective of taking turns in childcare. No one's using the toy. You can have a turn with it. Completely reasonable from that perspective. So I tried to say that someone had left it there to thank the person who had died on this dying stone for working for this country. In that moment, I decided to skip the word fighting because that would be a whole other conversation when you're coming from the preschool context. Navigating history is complicated. Well, that was fine, but still, to him, it had just been left there, and it was really being underused and underappreciated. It's just sitting there on the ground, and it should be high and waving, which truly is not disrespectful for the purpose of a flag. So I tried another round of the story, that the flag really belonged to the person who had died, and that they would want the flag to stay there with their dying stone. Well, it is a perilous business talking about what the dead would want. Even when people write down while they are alive what they want after they are dead, sometimes the world changes so much after their death, even in just a day, that their express wishes don't make sense anymore. One of the simplest, most tangible versions of this is that American flag that we found in the woods that day looked quite different than the flag looked when that person died in 17-something. I'm not sure which part of the 1700s this person died in, but it's possible there wasn't even really an American flag yet. So I could hardly say what that person would want in regards to this particular flag, given how much the country that they were connected to has changed in the centuries since their living. And I'm pretty clear that the flag is there for the living, as a way to honor our ancestors, to keep their stories and their purposes in our minds. Flags in graveyards are invitations to deep time, a sense of time that is longer than our lifetimes, that's longer than our family memories often. They are an invitation to see our present struggles and preoccupations in the scope of a much larger living. So eventually I convinced my child to march twice around the little graveyard in the woods, waving that flag high, and then returning it to the spot in the ground. And he told the person hovering over that stone, "You can have a turn again." And we stomped off into the muddy spring. I suspect that the person that that flag marked fought in the Revolutionary War, but maybe in some other skirmish with native people or the French. In any case, they fought for the creation of some version of the United States of America that we live in now. And we know that however they saw their fighting and their living, it looks very different from this moment in history. We know that all of these stories are more complex now. Why our nation fought the wars that it has fought, for whose interest and to what benefit, those stories are more complex now. And we know that many people who went to fight did it out of loyalty and commitment to high ideals. And that some people did it because they thought that is what their life demanded of them. And so they went. There are so many stories of people fighting for their lives, people struggling to live lives of principle and meaning. The poem that I read for you this morning by Jackie Germain is one of those poems about fighting for one's life, fighting for principles, fighting for a larger world that has a lot of layers in it. Of course, it's in the voice of a young African-American woman who is almost giving up on staying in college, almost giving up on the struggle for that kind of self-determination. We know that racism makes it harder for young people of color to stay in some institutions in our culture. So for her to describe her moment of recommitment, her moment of acceptance and stepping back into her struggle as an encounter with Nat Turner, the leader of the famous violent slave rebellion, is an astonishing move. From one perspective, he is the leader of a violent revolt, and from another perspective, he led the opening battle for emancipation, a war that the entire country took up a few years later, a war to free slaves, a war to free this country from the ravages of slavery. And it is that war that holds the kernel of Memorial Day, that when the African heritage people were indeed freed from slavery, they decorated the graves of the Union soldiers. And so the stories weave and interweave. One historian says, "To accept Nat Turner and place him within the pantheon of American revolutionary heroes is to sanction violence as a means of social change. He was a kind of radical consciousness that to this day troubles advocates of a racially reconciled society. The story lives because it is relevant today to questions of how to organize for change." Whatever you think about violent or nonviolent rebellion, If you look at the number of poems and books and plays and movies, another one just last year, I think, that have been made about Nat Turner, it is clear that he has a very important place in the identity and self-understanding of this nation. I think he is the instance where the brutality of the slave system erupted out of the experience of those people enslaved and into the experience of those people who held slaves. We might think about what Nat Turner did, not from the perspective of good and bad, because we have the gift of looking at it from deep time now, from a much wider perspective. But we might think about how and what we can expect from people who have experienced terrible brutality. When people are systematically repressed, some of those people are going to be angry enough and traumatized enough that violent action will seem like the only option. In fact, Nat Turner thought truly that God had told him that this is what he should do. If we want to end violence in the world, then yes, we have to teach nonviolence and respect, and that means that we need to end the systems of oppression that are so destructive to people's humanity that they get to this point, that violence seems like the only available option. Well, that's easy to say. And it makes me think about the Buddhist tenet of the interdependent arising of all phenomena. It's a nice, extremely abstract way of saying things call each other into being. I've talked about this some with Joanna Macy's work, and she says when we want to go out and change the world, we have to use two weapons, and she uses the word weapons because her Buddhist teacher said, use the word weapon. And one is this awareness that things call each other into being. So Nat Turner's violent rebellion came out of the violence that he had lived. And that these kinds of calling each other out of the world is part of the inevitable unfolding of life and death. And Joanna Macy says that her teacher said, if you're going to go out into the world and change it, you have to have the other tool to keep things in balance. So this awareness that things come and go and everything is connected. And the other tool is compassion. And Joanna Macy and her teacher talk about this as a warm tool or a hot tool, which means when you feel compassion, when you're close to things, to other people, to other experiences, it can be too much and you can burn out. Almost everyone has had that experience in some small way, if not some big way. And so we have to move back and forth between these two things. My little boy, who talks quite casually about death, right when he is in that brightest bloom of his early life, holds on to this balance. Children are such stunning teachers. Of course, life and death move together in the same moment in his world. It doesn't trouble him that they do. He may later find that more troubling, but for now, they call each other into being. And he's willing to approach almost anything. And that's the compassion part. He's willing to be close to it. My favorite definition of compassion is not keeping your distance from pain, your own pain or others' pain. It doesn't mean that you have to take on everyone else's pain. You just have to not keep your distance. And that's part of what is so striking in the poem about Nat Turner. He steps right up to the young woman struggling. and has her look at the pain of her heritage and her own pain. Look right at the hardest parts of it. And he stays right with her. And then he articulates what it's like to live with the pain. Our people know these two things best, water and salt. We cry when we run out of sweat. We sweat when we run out of cry. It is a dangerous business trying to speak for the dead, trying to imagine what they would say. So it's good, I think, to remember that it's all imagining in this moment when the dead speak in such specific words like this. When my wild child went stomping over the grave of Josephus or Jebediah or William, I like to imagine that that man looked up at this young life in frog boots. Who could have imagined that in 17, whatever? I like to imagine that that long ago life could see how much the world had changed. Looking forward from two or three centuries ago, the amount of change that has occurred is absolutely staggering. And standing in our spot in time, being in our present moment, change can seem slow, so slow and painful. The unresolved stories are heavy. The man buried in the woods, I like to think that he nodded at this flag-waving child and whispered through those greening trees, "You can have a turn now. Take it." And so my hope for you this Memorial Day weekend is that some fierce and compassionate ancestor will visit you, will urge you on, urge you to stay in a struggle that you think is too hard to stay in, that they will stand with you while you feel how hard it is, and that you will take your turn.